debt, war, corruption, treason, and an open season on human rights. Tears at the fabric of our nation, and the tragic realization is that future generations will pay the big price. Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully. This land is your land.
This land is my land.
If we come together and work together, we can pull the weeds that threaten to destroy our land. I hope and pray you understand we cannot reap a good harvest with a bunch of bad seeds. Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully. Abraham Lincoln proclaimed, "We are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations." He also observed, "You can fool all of the people some of the time, and some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time."
Wake up, shake it up, America.
Our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore them. America, north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully. Wake up and shake it up, America.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Taking Back America, the official show of Take Back America for the People. This is your host, Dr. Richard Stagenborg. I represent Taking Back America, which is a nonprofit whose mission is to educate Americans and people around the world about the costs of allowing corporate control of the U.S. government. Well, we're going to return to the subject of presidential politics this week. I'm going to be talking to one of the candidates for the nomination for U.S. president. Mimi Soltysik is the national co-chair of the Socialist Party USA. There's been a lot of talk about one socialist in the race already. That's Bernie Sanders, an independent running for the Democratic Party, but there's been a lot less attention paid to the official representative of the Socialist Party. And I think probably there's a pretty substantial difference between his vision of socialism and Bernie Sanders. So it's kind of neat to have them back to back. Mimi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Rick. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well, I'm glad we connected, and I'm really interested in hearing what you have to say, because as I mentioned, there's a lot of attention to the idea of electing someone who calls himself a democratic socialist to the U.S. presidency. Now, they're being very careful, his campaign and his supporters are being very careful to make a distinction between democratic socialism and the form of socialism where the workers own the means of production. See, there's that confusion coming in again.
Right.
Most people in their minds, they see a distinction there, but I noticed on your Facebook page recently you said that the democratic socialism is socialism. You want to explain what you mean by that?
Well, I can tell you that if they are making an effort to distance themselves from the idea that, socialism is worker control over the means of production, I'm not really sure I can say what they're subscribing to. It appears to me, from what I've seen throughout his campaign, that what they sort of support and promote is more of a social democracy, maybe what you see more in the Scandinavian countries, where you have a larger welfare state. You're still operating within a capitalist system. There's still a greater influence of the market. And, from where we're coming from, those aren't the ideas that we're putting forth. We, as a democratic socialist, what we put forth is worker control over the means of production. Democratic community participation in the institutions that most directly affect people's lives, their school, their healthcare, et cetera. So if there is that effort being made to distance themselves from worker control of the means of production, like I said, I'm not inside their campaign. I can't say why they might choose that strategically. I guess that's for them to explain.
Okay, but you do see a distinction between what's commonly referred to as democratic socialism and traditional socialism, which is what you're representing. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think that you can't really have socialism without democracy. Socialism is inherently democratic. So I think to some folks, the idea of democratic socialism may sound somewhat redundant. However, we do stress, like I said, that democratic participation of the community, the institutions that most directly affect their lives, that democratic participation is incredibly important. It extends, I think, beyond just the worker control over the means of production. It includes those community decisions, that are made at the grassroots level, at the local level.
Okay, great. I'm really glad that maybe some of our listeners think we're belaboring this point. If you already understand these points, it may be true, but because there's such confusion around these terms, I think it's really important that we explain what we're talking about before we launch into further discussion. And I think you
sure.
did a pretty good job of that, Mimi. By the way, before we go on, I want to mention to our listeners, we are still having technical problems, and that's forced us to do this over a cell phone, so that it's not going to be the kind of quality you will expect from us very soon when I get a new computer to do this show. Mimi, I'm sorry we don't give you the quality that you deserve for what you've got to say. So let's take these points one at a time. So first of all, you've dispelled the myth, I think, pretty well that there's some inherent conflict between socialism and democracy. Of course, probably most of our listeners already know that. But on the other hand, I wonder if they've all really thought through what democracy means.
Right.
The Constitution has set up a form of government that's a republic, sometimes
right.
Misleadingly referred to as a representative democracy. But from the socialist point of view, representative democracy is almost an oxymoron, it sounds like, if decisions are made at the local level. Is that right?
Well, I don't think that any of the representatives in our system of government that we elect to D.C. are representing the people. I would sort of balk at that idea that we are being represented by our elected officials. We're not. I think that those key decisions have to be made at the local level, where the folks at the local level, the folks who live in the communities, actually have a direct participatory influence in the decisions that are being made. The country is so large and so diverse, and our system of electoral politics is so incredibly influenced by corporations, by big money, lobbyists, et cetera. The idea that any of these folks are going to be representing our interests as people is laughable. And I think one of the things where this particular campaign may differ from what folks might expect from sort of your traditional electoral campaign is that we're using this campaign and sort of the spotlight that an electoral at this level campaign receives. We're using this to sort of shed the light on those sorts of ideas, that the critical decisions need to be made at the local level by the people themselves, not by the elected officials in D.C. So that was one of the key decisions in actually choosing to do this. One, we're aware that the public's attention is heightened during a presidential campaign. And two, in this particular campaign, because Bernie Sanders is running, he's using some of the language that now is an opportunity and an enhanced opportunity to speak as socialists about what these ideas mean, you know, how we might differ. And let's say that Bernie Sanders does not win in the primaries. So where do those folks go, the folks who sort of bought into those ideas or even inspired by those ideas, where do they go after the primaries? Do they turn to Hillary Clinton? Or, you know, are we able to sort of have a dialogue with them about what socialism means? And if they were sort of inspired by those ideas, you know, we're still going to be here. There are plenty of socialist organizations throughout the country that folks can tap into. But, you know, we're going to be here. We've been here for a long time. We are always working to sort of put forth those radical revolutionary ideas. And if people were turned on by what Sanders was saying publicly, well, they have a place that they can go to.
Very interesting. So that's another opportunity that the Sanders campaign represents, is for people with even more visionary ideal expansive visions for more substantial change have a chance to get their message out there. That's a very, very good point.
Right.
And I would also say that, of course, in addition to the Socialist Party, there are other parties. Last year, or last presidential election, the Green Party got 2% of the vote. What do you think? Do you think it would be a step forward if people who would have voted for Sanders in the general vote Green if he doesn't make it to the general?
Well, I think my perspective and the perspective of this campaign is that, you know, we are a radical, you know, socialist party. And I really believe that it doesn't matter who goes into office in D.C. They're not going to be able to make the kind of changes that we're, you know, putting forth. We're looking to change the system. I had said this, I think, in an interview with the Hampton Institute, that in some sort of fairy tale world where I might be elected president, if I were operating in good faith, I would fire myself on the first day because I would have so thoroughly betrayed those who believed in me in my sort of journey to get to the White House, that I'd be unfit to you know, represent those folks who put their faith in me. I would have so thoroughly compromised my beliefs, my ideas, to get through this system that me, a socialist sitting in the office, I'm not going to change the system. And that's what we're advocating, is a change of the economic system. We don't want a reformed capitalism. We don't want a green capitalism. We don't want capitalism, period. To us, capitalism is inherently oppressive. It is an inherently racist system. We want a system that's for the people. And that's what socialism delivers. And those kinds of changes to sort of deliver that revolutionary change, that's going to happen at the grassroots level, in the communities, at the local level. So as I mentioned before, one of the key focuses of this campaign is shedding light on those ideas, is letting people know that, you know, if you want this kind of radical change, it's going to happen with you. And what we want to be able to do with this campaign is use this platform to help connect people to the movement work that's on the ground, to help people build new relationships, to help people in any way that we can contribute, to plug them into that sort of work. So like I said, we are sort of taking a different approach with a presidential campaign, but that's something that personally I'm comfortable with. And if the delegates at the Socialist Party's convention next month are comfortable with it as well, hopefully I'll get the nomination.
Okay, well, you sort of anticipated my next question, which was, it was going to be, what would you do if you were president? And I guess you answered that, you'd resign, because
correct.
you'd have to make so many compromises to get there. Okay, so you answered my question well. So in your opinion, voting Green is not that much different than voting for one of the other parties because they don't want to change the system. And you're about changing the system.
They have a strategy, you know, that they, I'm sure they think, you know, this works for them, and that's fine. You know, I'm certainly not here to slander what the Greens might do. You know, they're of course free to do what they want to do, and that's great. You know, we do have throughout the country plenty of good working relationships with the Green Party throughout the country. And I imagine that we'll continue to work where we have common goals and that sort of stuff. We'll continue to work together. I also did mention, and you can see this on the campaign's Facebook page, that, you know, we want to do what we can and to make a contribution toward uniting folks where we have common goals. How can we work together around those common goals? You know, the left in the United States is so heavily fractured. It can be very sectarian at times. And one thing that we have done in Los Angeles where our local, the Socialist Party, every few months we host what we call a radical ruckus, where we invite as many groups on the left throughout the city as we possibly can to an event that is solely focused on having a good time, you know, where we can put aside sort of political differences and get to know one another as people, enjoy each other's company, share some laughs and that kind of thing, and hopefully establish working relationships that are going to sustain. And I think we've had three or four of those so far, and we've seen a range of different groups come into these, and we've made a lot of new friends, and I think we've made a lot of allies that are going to sustain long term. We're going to continue to do this, and I think the campaign can make a contribution in that sense that, look, you know, if you're fighting capitalism as a socialist, you're independent of the two-party system, you know, we can find common ground that we can work together. There's certainly a lot of work to do. We face tremendous obstacles. So, you know, we need all the all hands on deck, you know. And I think that I'm very optimistic about what might be possible.
Well, that's, you know, I'm so happy to hear you say that, because I don't hear enough people saying that. And I'm really glad you made clear that you're not in opposition to what the Green Party is trying to do. You simply are taking a different tack. And
right. It's just different.
Maybe your goals are slightly different too, but you're going to work together every chance you get. And I think you're exactly right. That's exactly what it's going to take.
Yep.
And I'm not hearing that from enough quarters. However, you know, it does kind of remind me of George Dimitrov's speech before the Eighth International in 1936, as the cloud of fascism was descending on Europe. You know, there's so much going on right now that resembles that time. And one of the main points he made in that speech, or at least something that really caught my ear, I wasn't around, but I read it.
Right, sure.
One of the things that caught my eye was that he said to other communists, he said, listen, you can't go out there and sell your ideology and expect people to join you. You need to join them. You need to work
right
side by side with them on your common goals. And then if our ideology is right, if this is the way to go, they'll see it eventually, but we have to help them get to that point where they can see it. And that means working with them from where they're at. So I don't see how we can possibly have any kind of revolution without doing it that way.
And, you know, and the truth of the matter is, you know, we're all members of our communities. You know, we go to work, we go to school. You know, we share spaces in our apartment buildings and that sort of stuff. So, you know, we stand side by side every day with the folks in our community. And I think, as opposed to sort of speaking at people, taking the position that we are telling them what's right for them. I think it's more about having a dialogue with the people, you know, and sharing that dialogue, learning from, you know, our friends, neighbors, families, coworkers, fellow students, and that sort of stuff, what's important to them. You know, on the basis of those experiences, well, you know, we as an organization, we can strategic plan, you know. It's something we do here in Los Angeles. We do our neighboring local here in L.A. is in Ventura County. We have strategic planning sessions where we put those experiences and those ideas down. You know, we do our environmental scans. We do our capacity assessments. And we figure out, you know, how to approach things on the basis of what we learn in those sessions. But, you know, the idea that we're just going to walk into a community and tell people this is what you need to do because we say so, to me, that's freaking silly, you know. And I fully expect folks, if they would say, get the hell out of here, you know, sure, that's understandable. I would say the same thing. You know, I often do it when folks come knocking on my door, you know, to sell me something, you know, like, hey, come on now, you know, we don't have a relationship. So, you know, I think I feel really good about the approach that we're taking. I think we can be as inclusive as possible. And another thing that I think we do a really good job at is sort of humanizing this. Frequently we'll hear from folks that when they see sort of the language that the left uses, that at times it can appear intimidating, you know, or they can feel that it's exclusive. So we make a lot of effort to be as warm and inclusive and as inviting as we possibly can. You know, I mean, we're real people. You know, we like to laugh. We like to watch movies. We like music. We like to dance and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, when we're operating as an organization, well, those kinds of things are very, very important, you know, to do what we can to, you know, diminish that feeling of intimidation that people have, you know, or that they're, I hear this almost every day that I'm intimidated, I'm scared, sort of get what folks are saying, but I don't entirely understand the language. And I think that puts a responsibility on us when we hear those kinds of things to figure out, well, what is it that we're doing that might be making people feel scared or intimidated? And how can we, you know, present ourselves in a way that's as human as possible?
That's really an interesting approach because it doesn't just make political sense. It also makes sense in terms of you're kind of helping shape a consciousness, a more group-oriented consciousness where people are more sensitive to communications issues and the different places people are at. It seems to me that's a very integral part of building a political movement is to change the consciousness.
Yes.
So I really like that strategy. Gosh, I hope we get lots of listeners to the show who are going to put that into practice. I also like the fact you're welcome. I also like the fact that you're doing this on a community level. You know, people seem to think it's either or. You either work at the national, international level or the community level. But the truth is you have to do all of them at the same time. You can work locally and think globally, but you better have a strategy that's global. Mm-hmm. And you're really acting globally as well as you're acting locally. So the main point I wanted to make is, why do you say that doing this at a local level is the way to focus people's energies on political change?
Well, I think that we see sort of a revolutionary movement happening from the top down. Certainly, as I mentioned before, in D.C., somebody, you know, who proclaims to be a socialist, you know, if they're elected president, you know, those battles that they're going to have and the compromises they will have made, they're not going to be able to deliver, you know, that sort of revolutionary promise. I think that historically we've seen how powerful the people are when the people mobilize around an idea. One example, you know, I think you and I might have talked about this before. is, you know, when we saw the Black Panther Party when they were doing the free breakfast programs and a lot of the community work that they were doing, really fantastic work in their local communities and really gained a lot of momentum. So much so, I think that as we have seen with like show and tell pro programs and that sort of thing, this started to become a real threat to sort of the establishment. And, you know, we see what happens when the people start to mobilize, and we see how threatening that people mobilization, how threatening that can be to power. And I think we have examples where we have seen when the folks get together at the community level, start to organize around ideas, start to stand in solidarity with one another, that this stuff, it can be tremendously powerful. And I think that's how this kind of thing would work. Now, I say this fully acknowledging, and as I mentioned, we saw this in the case of the Black Panthers, that when such things happen, yes, you fully expect a response from the powerful, as you know, their ability to sort of profit and prosper on the backs of you know, the working class, on the backs of the people. Well, they're going to do anything that they can to maintain that right to exploit the folks. And in the case of, you know, the Panthers, we saw that, well, you know, I think Hoover had, you know, determined Black Panthers were the greatest threat to national security. And, of course, you know, it's funny. This is an organization that's, you know, delivering free breakfasts to children and doing a lot of work in their communities to you know, improve the quality of life and all that sort of thing. Somehow that ends up being the greatest threat to national security. And then, you know, like I mentioned, the COINTELPRO program, you know, the efforts to infiltrate and in some cases assassinate, like we saw with Fred Hampton. You know, this kind of thing can be very threatening, I think, to the powerful. And, you know, we do acknowledge that. We have a long way to go till we get to that kind of point. They were really tremendous in what they achieved, and I have a lot of respect for what they had done. But that's sort of, you know, that serves as a good blueprint for what might be possible.
Okay, so we have lots of examples of grassroots organizing in the past that's shown the potential to become a real national, even international movement, like the Black Panther movement. King's movement also was considered a grave national threat by Hoover and the other
right.
guys. And then after they killed him, Malcolm X was the big
right.
threat. And then,
sure.
And that's really one of the major factors that gave rise, I think, I'm not an expert, to the Black Panthers. Certainly they got the most attention after that because people just got more and more militant. And I'm not saying they were violent. I mean, they organized self-defense, which is a different thing. And there's a lot of people on both the left and right who are talking about self-defense right now, primarily on the right, because your people on the left, your self-identified liberals, a lot of them, once a Democrat's in office, they think everything's hunky-dory and they're willing to ignore things like the NDAA.
Right, right.
And you must be an Alex Jones fan or something.
Right. I don't even know where to start with. It's called the idea that, Democrat office that somehow we become more, dovish or peaceful nation is, you know, obviously that's a joke. You know, I think we've already seen that, you know, Bernie Sanders has said that if elected, he will not stop the drone program. Perhaps he may have said he'll be more selective in how he uses the drone program. But, you know, a lot of this shit we've heard before with Obama in 2008, 2012, and, you know, these programs like drone programs, you know, indiscriminate killing of civilians, you know, throughout the world is just unacceptable. I often find to you, me, anybody else, let's just say hypothetically that it was, you know, somebody that we loved or cared about that was killed by a quote-unquote errant drone strike. how might we respond, you know, if that's mother, father, children, just anybody that we care about, how might we respond, you know, putting ourselves in the shoes of folks, you know, throughout the world who are on the receiving end of U.S. aggression. I think it's perfectly reasonable to see folks respond in sort of desperation and pain, you know, when their loved ones, their community members are killed by this kind of aggression. Seeing that response in desperation and pain and what that might result in, it's understandable to me, you know. And you can say that while simultaneously saying, well, I don't condone violence. However, you know, when these things happen, which they happen all the time, you know, the killing of innocent throughout the world, boy, I you understand. You want to cry for, you know, folks that this happened to. And the idea to me that our tax money finances this stuff, it's just unconscionable, you know. We should be disgusted, and we should demand that systemic change so that this stuff does not happen. You know, we're creating enemies all over the place, all the time. You know, when countries historically sort of stand in opposition to the U.S. imperialism, well, I mean, as you well know, you know, we'll do what we can do to bring about regime change. You know, whether it's Allende in Chile or Lumumba in, you know, the Congo, wherever it's going to be, or Mossadegh in Iran, you know, if folks start talking about nationalizing their resources and shunning the multinational corporations, the Bechtels, ITTs, whatever it might be, well, we're going to say that's not cool. We're going to bring about regime change. We're going to bring the CIA in, and we're going to do what we can do to make that happen. You know, this stuff is just unconscionable.
I totally agree, but let me just stop you there because I want to make one point clear to our listeners. When you say nationalize resources, you're not talking about the people seizing private property in the United States, although you may advocate that. But you were talking specifically about people in other countries claiming the right to manage their own resources that have been expropriated by the empire. Is that
in the cases that I mentioned? Right, that, you know, okay. Oil or, you know, copper, you know, that sort of thing. You know, countries. Absolutely, you know, this. We can go on and on with this sort of thing. You know, and again, we finance this stuff as taxpayers. It is just unconscionable.
Yeah, absolutely, and I'm glad you brought that up because I think, you know, we had an advocate for Bernie Sanders on last week, and I think we agreed that he really is very weak on foreign policy for whatever reason, and I'm not endorsing anybody, you or him or anybody else, because this
sure.
is, after all, a 501c3. But
right.
It is important to make these distinctions, and one of the distinctions we made was Hillary Clinton has a record that clearly marks her as much more imperialist in every way than either one of you. I mean, he at least opposed the Iraq wars, both of them, and the invasion of Afghanistan. So he's not totally blind to imperialism, but I totally agree with you. He's not. We need to educate him if he happens to get the opportunity to have a big platform. But that's not what this show is about. This show is about
sure.
your ideas on how to create a real democracy. Talk about doing it at a local level. Talk mm-hmm. about working, building bridges between different people
right.
working in different ways to build a movement.
Right.
Yes. And the goal, the ultimate goal, I think I'd like to talk a little bit about that because, as we said at the beginning, the ultimate goal, or one of them anyway, is worker ownership of the means of production. What do
right.
you envision that entailing?
Well, you know, I think, one, it's an acknowledgement that this is it is complex. It is going to require, again, you know, strategic planning. But I do think, you know, we do have examples of worker cooperatives. There's quite a, you know, there's a large number in the U.S., and certainly there's a large number throughout the world. We do have, you know, so we have examples of how workers' cooperatives, how they work. You know, the evidence is there. There's a lot of material that's been written about that sort of thing. I know Richard D. Wolff, the Economist, writes a lot about it. I think Garl Perowitz has written a lot about it. So, you know, to some extent, I think that we can look at examples that already exist. How do we do this sort of thing? And, you know, beyond that, I think it's, you know, it's on the community level. It's developing new cooperatives, collectives where they don't exist, you know, to deliver on like those key services that we need.
Well, now, I bet you a lot of people are not that familiar with what you're talking about when you talk about worker cooperatives. And I assume you mean
sure.
things like Mondragon and the Cleveland Project. Do you want to explain to people what that means?
I think people can look at, you know, I don't know. Mondragon's an example. I do think there are some problems within the Mondragon example. But I think that's one, it's sort of a high profile example that people can look at. I would heavily suggest, you know, people look at Richard D. Wolff and look at the work that he's done on worker cooperatives. But let's just say hypothetically that, I don't know, 20 people in my community, you know, we, I don't know, we do a t-shirt printing business, you know, we have collective ownership of this business. We collectively decide on the allocation of, you know, the revenue that we make. And we all collectively decide, you know, the decisions that are made for the company. Everybody has an input into what this company does. And there is not the management. There is not the executive class that, you know, takes that big chunk that's determined by the market of our labor for themselves. You know, that goes to us, you know, the workers. This is what we work for. That revenue is ours. You know, the decisions that are made, we as the workers who are hands-on, you know, with the means of production, who have that experience, who have that expertise, we are in an extraordinary place to make well-informed decisions on how that might operate within the company. And collectively, we, the workers, decide what we're going to do, you know, the allocation of the revenue, et cetera.
Okay, so, and that, I think, that would apply to any of the models that we talked about, despite the differences in some of the details. That would apply to Mondragon, for instance, as well as Cleveland. And I guess there's another large project that started recently. I can't remember where. But I didn't know Richard Wolff was writing a lot about that. I see him quoted a lot in mainstream media, and I'm really glad to hear that he's talking about things like that. In fact,
yes,
I just looked him
up.
He's described as a Marxist economist, which
correct.
Kind of surprises me that he gets that much attention. I had no idea. I guess I should listen,
I
listen more carefully.
Really, I think he's doing quite well. We interviewed him a bit ago for the Socialist Party's webzine, which is just thesocialist.us. Our local here in Los Angeles interviewed him. But he, you know, he writes quite, he's pretty prolific. He has a podcast and he discusses these issues, you know, sort of in an acknowledgement that capitalism is a failure for the people. He discusses, you know, sort of the transformative process. How are we going to make our way out of this capitalist mess, to a democratic, you know, participatory society. And he does discuss a lot sort of the worker issues, you know, how our companies might work and that sort of thing. So, like I said, he has a podcast on his website. You know, definitely encourage people to check it out. It gives one glimpse into how workers cooperatives can work.
That is so exciting to me because, like I said, I didn't even realize that he had that orientation, a Marxist orientation, and I think that speaks to his ability to translate these concepts into everyday language that everybody can relate to, as opposed to a lot of jargon you mentioned earlier is kind of intimidating to people. That jargon is a shorthand for people who are getting deeply into the concepts, I think. but it's a lot less useful when you're trying to educate the general public, in my opinion. Have you had that experience?
I would agree with you. I think that's why Richard D. Wolf, you know, sort of the popularity that he's seen, he does a really good job of making what might seem daunting for a lot of folks, really sort of presenting it in a way that folks can understand easily. They can make connections to the message with their daily lives. And in that regard, as I mentioned before, I feel really optimistic. I think that when we as socialists speak to folks as, you know, as members of the community, humanize this stuff. I mean, you know, to, you know, sit at a community center and, you know, read to the community, you know, volume one of Marx's Capital. That's a pretty tough task, you know. but if we speak as friends, neighbors, family members, and that sort of thing, I think that, you know, the potential is there to see a lot of folks, to see these ideas really resonate with people. And often one of the challenges that we have is, you know, that in terms of overall numbers, you know, we're not that great. The Socialist Party USA is certainly not the size of the Socialist Party of America, you know, 100 years ago. But when any one of us has the opportunity to speak to folks one-on-one, one-on-two, one-on-three, and one-on-four, and have that discussion and the dialogue, the ideas generally tend to make sense to a lot of people. You know, the issue is how many folks can we reach in our communities and have the dialogue with? You know, I look at this as, boy, when one new person comes into the fold and there's somebody who can sort of reach their community, that's gold. That's just amazing, you know, and it's so important. It's so valuable. So, you know, this is a marathon, you know, it's not a sprint. You know, we're practical about how, you know, all this works, but each one of us can be sort of like an agent of change, you know, somebody who's a member of the community, who has a message, who has an idea, you know, and who has sort of a community that they interact with all the time, you know, So I'm like I said, very optimistic.
Well, I don't blame you. I see a lot of things converging towards these ideas. Again, without using the term necessarily socialism or, God forbid, communism. I think if you avoid those terms and just talk about the concepts while avoiding the jargon, it really does resonate. I mean, that's why Marx was so popular in the first place, because the ideas made sense.
They do. And let me just say one thing real quick, Rick. I think that what we find is that, you know, when we have these interactions as people, we actually don't even have to shy away from those terms because, you know, we have relationships that we've already established, you know, whether they be friends, families, coworkers, and that sort of thing. There is trust. You know, there is a human relationship. And what we can find is that we don't have to run from the words because that relationship is being built. And you know, there's a value to that relationship. There's a trust, you know. And I think that one thing that's been great about the Internet is that it becomes much more difficult, I think, to cast these words as pejorative because people can quickly fact check right now in ways that they hadn't been able to before. So, you know, if Fox News or whoever tries to, you know, frame socialism as something that's, you know, evil or scary, you know, folks can find out rather quickly, well, what does this mean, you know? So many folks are, you know, connected to social media, et cetera. Folks can find out rather quickly, what does this mean? What sort of incentive do they, whether it be Fox News or whoever, have in casting these words in sort of this negative light? You know, folks can fact check very quickly. And the opportunity is great to stand up and say, you know what, I am a socialist. I am not apologetic. You know, I'm ready to have a dialogue, you know, and it, sometimes it's remarkable, especially here in LA, about how receptive folks are. You know, I think folks are thoroughly sick of having their asses kicked, you know, and are well aware that they've been sold out by their, you know, elected officials. You know, finding work is so incredibly tough. The cost of tuition is just unbelievable. You know, the prison industrial complex is a freaking nightmare. You know, the police brutality, the police oppression. And I think folks are ready for real substantive change, you know, and their trust in those elected officials, the Democratic Party, the Republican Party officials, you know, it's gone. It's you know, I think the game is over. At the very least, it's soon over, you know. So now we assert ourselves and say, you know, we're not sorry that we're socialists or communists or whatever. You know, we are who we are. You know, we have the right to talk about our ideas. And like I said, folks have been really receptive.
Well, that's great. And I think it really brings up a really important point. It's not trivial at all, because this is a question I don't hear people debating. And that is, should we be emphasizing the fact that socialism should not be considered a dirty word, and people need to debate these concepts, need to debate whether capitalism serves the interests of anybody, whether it's possible
right.
to have capitalism and democracy in the same system? That's a question we need to discuss for sure.
Sure.
But on the other hand, other people will say, yeah, but even revolution, it doesn't necessarily happen all at once. You can think of a wheel, still has to go point to point to point before it completely revolves. And so they would say, we can't start out that way. We have to start out by describing what we mean but avoiding the term. And then the question is, well, at what point do you go from one to the other? And it's the same argument if you look at the obverse, and that is, what kind of a system do we have now?
Right.
People are afraid to use the term fascist, but if you look at the definition, I mean, there's a lot of definitions. But if you look at the characteristics of a fascist government and a fascist society, the United States meets every criteria, I think,
right.
inarguably, except it doesn't have a dictator. Some people say that's a requirement for fascism. I say it shouldn't be if the system is otherwise identical. I mean, the difference is that the people of the United States have willingly given up their government to corporate interests, as opposed to an individual representing corporate interests.
And I would sort of challenge the idea that, you know, okay, we don't have a dictator, you know, insofar as that we have one single person who's governing over X amount of, you know, over an extended period of time. But we have a two-party system. You know, there are sort of, you know, arguably there are differences between the two. You know, what they deliver for the people, both in the U.S. and internationally, is generally bad news. And for, you know, a third-party candidate for more inclusion of, you know, alternative voices into this system, it is incredibly difficult. So, you know, I feel that we do, in a sense, have a dictatorship, and it's a dictatorship of the capitalist class, the capitalist parties. You know, the efforts that they'll make to take to ensure the exclusion of, you know, different voices and ideas into the you know, the process, that, you know, they'll spare no expense. I mean, you know, one of our candidates is not going to be in the, you know, the presidential debates, nor are, you know, any of the other third parties. You know, folks, you know, really, they have a limited opportunity to hear these voices, especially sort of on the mass media level. Now, you know, of course, the internet and, you know, like Block Talk Radio and that sort of thing, you know, we can do what we can to get these voices out there. But at the mass level, they have such a stranglehold over, you know, inclusion of those voices that, boy, it feels awfully a lot like a dictatorship to me.
Well, I agree. I think there's very little difference between a plutocracy and a dictatorship.
Right.
In a dictatorship, there's just a figurehead.
Right. Absolutely.
The dictator isn't really calling all the shots. That's ridiculous. This isn't Imperial Rome. And even in Imperial Rome, Julius Caesar had to consider, you know, various other power factions.
Right.
So, go ahead.
So I was just going to say, you know, I think, like you said, we sort of do meet, you know, the criteria for fascism. I mean, I think maybe, you know, we saw with Occupy sort of, well, it was like a boy, I don't want to say it's a hiccup, but sort of a manifestation of, you know, sort of, boy, dissent, or, you know, look, we're not having it anymore. The Black Lives Matter movement, you know, we are seeing sort of these signs that, you know, the people have just had it, you know. And I think in many cases, you know, there's so many folks out there who are so frustrated, disheartened, and feel such despair. Maybe they don't quite know how to articulate or sort of point that frustration in a particular place, but they're finding their voices now, you know. So I think we're seeing an acceleration of this process. You know, I think by choosing on our end to, you know, run a presidential campaign and considering all the things that come with, even at the third party level with the presidential campaign, you know, we're going to do what we can do to help accelerate that process.
Well, that's great. I've been saying for years, I don't know if you know, I ran for the U.S. Senate myself in 2010, and of course I didn't really expect to beat a multi-term incumbent with no money behind me or anything, but my purpose was to make people think about the possibility that we might actually be able to do something important to address corruption within the system as it was. And so it's a sort of an inside strategy as opposed to your outside grassroots strategy, which
sure.
I love also.
Thank you.
But the point was to highlight corruption in the system. Now, when you deliver your message, is that something that you focus on a lot? Because I certainly always, as an individual and as the head of this nonprofit,
sure.
I do encourage people to talk about, whether they're candidates or not, to talk about how corruption is related to all these other problems. So is that a message you want to focus on if you get the nomination?
As opposed to maybe that there is corruption in the system, our message might be the system is inherently corrupt, that the
okay.
corruption that we're seeing is sort of inherent to the capitalist system. You can't have one without the other. You know, as we spoke about earlier, you know, we don't have a democracy. You know, capitalism is not democratic. You know, the workers do not have a say in the workplace. So, you know, the approach is going to be a little bit different. Yes, we, you know, there is a focus, you know, or an acknowledgement that there is corruption. But at the same time, you know, we're going to say that, well, you know, this system is inherently corrupt. It is delivering as intended. You know, the system is built on accumulation. You know, when we consider ideas like climate change, you know, well, capitalism, you know, as it's doing what it's supposed to do, it has to accumulate. You know, well, we have finite resources on the planet. The planet can only handle so much, you know. So if capitalism ceases to accumulate, well, it ceases to be capitalism, you know. So if we take an issue like climate change, boy, we can really deliver an urgent message here that, like, look, this isn't a bargain. We're not bartering here, you know. The facts, the science tells us that we really don't have much time, you know. Every day we're running out of more time. So every day that we choose to bargain with this system, reform this system, you know, it's like these minor delays of the inevitable, these minor inconsequential delays of the inevitable. No, we can't have it. You know, at the very least, if we, you know, care about our home, if we care about one another, if we care about our future, you know, we're going to start taking these kinds of things seriously and listening to what the science is telling us. So, you know, sort of see that corruption is inherent to what's going on here.
Well, I certainly understand that argument. I guess my only question is, are
sure.
you going to reach people and raise consciousness faster by taking that approach, or again by starting where they're at and just keep hammering over their heads, look how corrupt it is, and point to the root causes, which even if you don't say it's capitalism itself, they amount to a critique of capitalism. Again, you know, just a different strategy,
sure.
I guess. But by focusing, by putting them under the heading of corruption, my thought was, and is still to some extent, that's something everybody understands. You know, 99% of people don't need to be convinced that the government's corrupt. What we have to do is point out to the root causes, which you're putting in terms of capitalism, as opposed to alternative systems that people aren't ready to, a lot of people aren't ready to talk about. It's a different strategy, and it makes sense.
It is, right.
You've made your case. This is a different day and age. People are openly talking about socialism with somebody
for
like
sure.
Bernie Sanders running. You're clarifying what socialism really is, running around behind him, talking about what it really is.
And you know what, Rick? I feel like this. Okay, so I'm the male co-chair of the Socialist Party. If people aren't understanding what I'm saying, that's my responsibility. That's a failure on my part. So if I'm trying to convey a message that the system, it's inherently corrupt, and that's the way it's designed to work, if people aren't understanding what it is that I'm saying, that's my failure, you know? That's my responsibility. And I have to, again, you know, we mentioned the word strategy. I have to look at how it is that I conduct my messaging, you know? And be willing to sort of engage in a serious bout of self-criticism, you know, and analysis. You know, am I delivering my message in the best way possible? You know, what mediums am I using? What sort of approaches am I taking? You know, I believe so thoroughly in the ideas. Somehow they reached me, you know. So, you know, I think in terms of getting that message out there effectively, I just have to look, you know, as one person, what's the best I can do, you know? How
exactly.
can I continually improve, you know?
Exactly, and I really admire that approach. I think if we all did that and gave allowances for other people having different points of view, that together, using a variety of approaches, we can wake people up. And again, as Dimitrov said, if we really have the same vision and we have different ways of trying to wake people up to what it is, and circumstances are forcing them to question their assumptions as things get worse and worse, hopefully together we will get that message across that what we need is a radical transformation, not just piecemeal reforms, even though I'm personally advocating some reforms.
Sure.
Just a disclaimer there.
Sure.
My ultimate goal is a radical transformation. Because you're absolutely right. On a finite planet, you cannot have eternal growth. Believe it or not, let me just tell you a little story to tell you why this is so hard to get across to people. I wrote a little editorial about that called "You Cannot Maintain a Growth-Based Economy" or something like that, and it talked about the limits of growth. And how it was inherent in capitalism, you always had to grow. Well, I didn't specifically criticize capitalism, but I still made the point. And I submitted this to a local Democratic newspaper, and the guy said, "Oh no, you haven't really thought this through." And I said, "What?
Wow.
What? This guy's a teacher.
Right.
This guy's a teacher." And I said,
"Oh,
wait a minute."
Yeah.
I said, "Wait a minute." I said, "Thank God you're not a math teacher." And he said, "I am."
Oh boy! Wow,
that's what we're up against, you know. But certainly, we need to try every approach we can.
Yeah.
But anyway, Mini Liz, I just realized we're out of time. I didn't even give you a warning there. But
oh,
I got to tell
okay.
you, this has been such a fun conversation that
I enjoyed it too.
Maybe we'll have
Thank
you back
you.
On sometime after you get the nomination of the Socialist Party USA and see how
That'd
things
That'd be wonderful.
Going.
Sounds good. Thank you so much, Rick. I appreciate it.
That's it for this week on Taking Back America. Join us next week.